All right, we'll now call a meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. Representative Clark Johnson, do you have an amendment? There are, I believe you have two amendments, or you could possibly coalesce both motions into one amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes for both March 14th and for March 16th.
Thank you. Having heard the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. First up today, Representative Erdahl, House File 380. I will move your bill to be re-referred to Ways and Means. That's what it says on my sheet here, Representative Erdahl. Don't look so puzzled. Where do you think you're going?
I would like possible inclusion.
I see. We'll confer about that while you're doing your presentation, Representative Erdahl. The motion is subject to editing.
All right. Thank you. We all know that drivers are supposed to stop when the red stop arm comes down on a school bus. Each year in Minnesota, we survey our bus drivers and ask them to count violations that occur in one day. 2,700 drivers took part. There are about 10,000 trips in a day. In the past 5 years, the previous years of 2016, there were 533 school bus crashes, resulting in 7 deaths and 211 injuries to those involved. The average count in Minnesota is 400 violations of the school bus stop arm each day, or approximately 72,000 per year. There are about 300 convictions a year. We need to do something to help stop this, and this bill, I would hope, would raise awareness as to the problem that we're having in Minnesota. Just a couple months ago, 3 were critically injured when a pickup ran a stop arm in Otsego. House File 380 will increase the penalty for this violation from $300 to $500. It would still be a misdemeanor. It would also help raise awareness in Minnesota about this grave safety issue. We could do more. Is it a panacea for the problem? No. But it is a start, and hopefully people will pay more attention. Hopefully we could do more in maybe public service or driver's training, which is not part of this bill, but those are some areas where we could do more. We're going to show a short video here of one example. Watch to the right here. This is by Painesville. School bus stops, door open. And there goes a truck.
Wow.
This was driven by a gentleman named Alan Morris, who, because he passed on the right when people were, I believe, getting on and not getting off, he got a gross misdemeanor, spent 245 days in jail and 2 years probation. But for most instances, it's still a misdemeanor. And that's the intent of this bill, just to raise the fine. Mr. Kelleher will give you a little bit of what happened in 2016.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Kelleher. I represent the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We've been working on this bill for about the last 3 years. There's a national survey that takes place on one day in the spring that a bunch of 2,600 school bus drivers in the state participate in, and they report in about 500 violations. There are about 600 to 800 convictions a year over the last 5 years. A lot of the charges are stayed. They are they lower the fine. They will adjudicate stay the ticket if the driver behaves themselves for 90 days. We feel that, as Representative Erdahl said, that raising the fine will hopefully raise some awareness, that some people start getting $500 fines for this violation. They'll start telling their friends to be very careful around the yellow school buses. That's the gist of it.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. I do see a member question from Representative Salk first.
I'm just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, isn't some of the impact lost when you have a whole large number, because I got the sense that a lot of plead down and all of these changes to it. And so I'm curious why a little bit of nibbling at that wouldn't also help.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Keller.
Representative Salk, there had been a provision in this bill called masking. It's in the commercial driver's license law, so that a judge, an agent of the court, can't lessen a fine on a commercial driver's license. And we just had taken that paragraph and put it in this bill originally. Unfortunately, in the previous committee, there were a number of attorneys that had a great uncomfort with that, the inability to negotiate with the prosecutor and or the judge to do what we're trying to stop, which is to make people have a $500 fine. We want it to be painful. You know, it's a big yellow school bus. Kids are getting on and off of it. It's not real complicated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salk, in other words,
Representative Erdahl,
we can't pass a bill with that in there. And this is the best I could do. We had actually another provision in there as well that wasn't going to work.
Understood. Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the figures are really shocking when it's a school bus, but beyond that, most of us know people are driving through red lights as well. So we have a really behavior problem that we need to be dealing with. And I don't know if there's anybody from MnDOT here, but we have that zero death program. So I'm just wondering, they seem to be doing the most, I guess, putting out PR. So would that be, have they ever done anything with school buses?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, we have a safety expo once a year where we try to, you know, remind the drivers to report these instances to the company that they work for and to the police department. It's often difficult to track down the exact driver. Many more of our buses are having cameras inside and outside now. That's why you can see the film. So that's helping us get the driver's license plate and a picture of the person in the car, hopefully. Because there's been some problems with, I wasn't driving the car, my son was, or my neighbor was. So it's really not a great way to fix that either. We're trying to, I represent the school bus industry, and we've been working on this. It's a problem, and we thought we'd fix this piece.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of problems, as I said, with people following rules. I will vote for the bill. I don't think the cost is anything that will make a big difference, but I will, you know, I'll vote for the bill because we, as I said, it's the only thing you've got right now.
Representative Baker.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thanks for bringing this, Representative Erdahl. This just happened right up on Highway 23 north of us. I think on the two-lane section of Highway 23 we're trying to get fixed to a four-lane highway. However, what I don't know is the money that is collected now from fines on this, do they go to a specific fund? Do they go to a school bus improvement safety fund when they have to improve? Because I know that right now when I drive by a school bus, some have the bright LED flashing lights, some maybe don't. Some have the arms that go over, some don't. I'm just kind of curious if there is a fund there that is funded through things like this. I'm just kind of curious of how that works. Thank you.
Representative Baker, Mr. Chairman, it goes to the general fund.
Thank you.
I do not see any other questions. Any final comments, Representative Erdahl?
No, just appreciate the opportunity to address this important issue and appreciate your support.
President Erdahl, I want to keep all of your options open, so I'm going to renew my motion that your bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Your bill is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative West, House File 1518. I will move that House File 1518 be re-referred to the General Register. Go ahead, Representative West. Representative West, is this your first time before this? Have you been here before? Shucks. I was hoping for some dessert, Representative West. Okay, you're good.
Sorry, I didn't get it. Yeah, there's documented proof I was here. I also have an amendment
office amendment that we get the bill in the sheet.
All right. We have an amendment to House File 1518. I will move your amendment, Representative West. I'll move the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Your bill is amended, Representative West. Go ahead.
That amendment was just matching with the amendment that's adopted in the Senate, so we don't have any incongruities between the two bills. House File 1518 allows the deputy registrars to store some documents electronically. Right now, they have to store everything for time ranging from 5-6 years in storage, and that can take up a lot of space. High-volume offices have entire basements filled with documents, and then they have to rent out secure storage off-site just to store more documents. And then when the state, say, requests a driver's license application from 4 years ago, they have to send somebody out to the secure storage site to get the thing, and it's a whole long, arduous process. If they're allowed to store them electronically, we have standards laid out in this bill to ensure it's secure. And with electronic medium, obviously, you'll be able to send things via email, and the entire process will go much smoother, and it'll be more customer-friendly, save the deputy registrar's money in the long term, and it's just a lot more practical in our modern age. And I have Jim Hurst here with me from the deputy registrar's office who can provide more details.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. Thank you, members, for hearing this bill today. This legislation comes back from last session when simply the clock ran out on us before we could have this measure enacted. This is an option for deputy officers. This is deputy registrars, excuse me. These offices are not mandated to pursue this, but rather it is an option for especially high-volume offices, as the author mentioned. And certainly the high volume of paper and documents are such that this would certainly assist these offices, and any office that chose to do this would do so at their own cost. So there is no cost to state government. With that, members, I would take questions from you as you see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This would be for either of you. I'm curious, are you concerned about two systems then being operated? One would be a paper system in the smaller offices, and one would be an electronic system in the larger offices?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we're not overly concerned about having two different type of systems here. Quite honestly, this is only for paper retention or document retention. Once the transaction has been conducted between the deputy and the customer, the information is submitted to the state immediately. So what this is for the retention of these documents, that in case the state 3-4 years down the road contacts us and says, we would like to see a copy of that application, can you retrieve it for us? We then can provide it. And that does not happen very often. It's rather rare that does happen. So that's the type of retention that we're talking about for these documents in these cases.
Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the chair is extremely efficient in adopting the amendment. I had a quick question on there. So it's a follow-up question then to the amendment. So as I read it here, it's referring to establishing the standards and specifically the term under this section. So I'm seeking clarification, as you're aware, that we worked on standards that have to be developed for both the electronic and for the physical. So this amendment is referring to those standards for the physical, not the previous section, as I read. Is that correct?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lucero, the amendment was requested by the other body on Friday last week, and I apologize, I have this cold. I haven't had a chance to confer with you because I recognize your input in establishing the FBI CJIS standards, which is a very good thing to strengthen this bill, and the other body wholeheartedly adopted that. These provisions are in statute in the bill, but Section 3 pertains to the standards that the state must come up with later this year. There was concern in the other body that without putting a sunset on their ability to set the standards, that they did not want it to be left open-ended. However, the underlying requirements of being subject to the FDIC standards remain in the bill going forward. So it's only the amendment only pertains to the ability of the department to make ongoing future standards that may or may not be related to this. So that's what the purpose of the amendment from the Senate was.
Follow-up, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up to that. And that's how I read this, because the Section 2 is referring to the standards for digital storage, and Section 3 is referring to standards for... Oh, actually, because I'm looking at the title of Section 3, it says electronic storage standards. Okay, you know what? That clarifies, just reading the title there clarifies my question. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You've asked and answered your own question.
Well,
very creative. I do not see any other questions from members. Any final comments, Representative West?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing my bill.
I would renew my motion that House File 1518 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You're on your way.
Thank you, sir.
I can go. Well, members, before we go to the next bill, I would like to spend a little bit of time just kind of going over what's going to be happening this week. As you know, things are very quickly approaching deadlines, and because of that, our schedule is going to be somewhat adjusted to accommodate the rollout of our transportation bill. Tomorrow, we will meet at the regular time, and the bill will be handed out at that time. And it will be amended as a delete all to House File 861. We will go through the bill, but we will not be taking testimony or amendments tomorrow. Wednesday, we'll be meeting at 1 p.m., and we'll continue that. We're going to actually extend the meeting time available. The room is available till 4:45, so we're going to extend our time from 1 p.m. to 4:45. And we will be taking testimony on the bill at that time. So any interest groups or others that want to testify to the bill can do that on an extended hearing time on Wednesday. And then amendments to the bill will be due at 5 p.m. on Wednesday. Thursday, we will mark up the bill in committee and at our regular time on Thursday. So we have an additional meeting scheduled for Wednesday. Representative Runbeck's committee didn't need her time, so we're taking that. And we do have a chance to continue our meeting on Thursday in the evening if necessary. But we'll see how that goes on Thursday. So any questions about the schedule for the rest of this week, members? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for letting us know, you know, ahead of time the roadmap here. Do you anticipate tomorrow we'll be able to get through the bill at our regular time? We won't be coming back in the afternoon or evening.
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein, for that question. Yes, I do anticipate that we will do a walkthrough of the bill tomorrow during regular time. I'm trying to find a time tomorrow morning where we could invite members of the minority from the committee to have a chance to look at the bill prior to committee time. I don't know that we have found a time yet, but it would have to be in the morning tomorrow. And
we appreciate that, Mr.
I will. I realize it's very short notice, and you may not all be able to come, but if we can find some time in my schedule and a place to meet, we will schedule something. So stay tuned for that. That would be prior to the rollout of the bill tomorrow afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I know around here this is not an easy question to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you foresee what next week might look like?
I usually operate in 15-minute increments, Representative Bernardi, so
I
next week
face,
is
Mr. Chair.
Just way too far away. We know the deadline is on the 31st, right. So this bill has to go to taxes, or the bill that we'll be hearing this week needs to go to taxes and ways and means and rules before it gets to the floor. So you can imagine that there are steps to be taken next week.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall our conversation the other day walking along Rice Street, and I really do appreciate you scheduling this in a way that I can have some time to study the bill and work with it, and more importantly, the public can do that. I do appreciate that. That doesn't always happen, but I think it makes for better policy. That's a great step. The other thing is I just want to renew my offer to you that I informally made. You'll recall that I shared that when I was a college professor, I always let my students submit their paper, and then I'd give them feedback, and then they could resubmit. And so I just want, if you want to send me a copy of that bill tonight, I'm more than glad to provide you some of that feedback to help you that you could incorporate in the bill on Tuesday. So just wanted you to know that offer still stands, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Representative Johnson, for that kind offer. I know that you're well qualified to correct my English, but actually I was thinking in the other direction. I'm going to require you to leave your red pen in your office when you come to the huddle tomorrow morning. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, and Representative Torkelson, I guess I was thinking about maybe correcting the English. I was actually thinking a little bit more along the lines of that you might need some help with the content. So I'm really glad that the offer just stands. Thank you, sir.
Well, in that, thank you, Representative Johnson, but in that area you may not be quite as well qualified.
You can always do amendments, Mr. Representative Johnson.
With that, we will continue to... through our hearing, and we'll pick up House File 1480, Representative Runbeck's bill. And when she gets to the stand, I will allow her to move her own bill. Representative Runbeck, you want to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1480, and I'm not sure which direction
it's going.
I believe
the destination is Ways and Means, Representative.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. And I do have a handout, and the page is available. And it's a piece we've all seen, I think, just showing sort of the multi-headed planning and funding situation we have with Met Council and the transit operation. So please take a look at that, because what the bill does is kind of put together one source for a comprehensive report annually to the legislature on transit. If you're trying to follow it now, we've got the Guideways report, we have a CTIB report, we have presentations, various kinds of presentations, but it's very hard to get a picture of what is happening in transit, what we're actually spending, what the performance standards are, what the operating costs per passenger are. And really, if you're making decisions about a very large system, which this is now, it's something like just currently before the planned light rail, it's $600 million annually. And the legislature is actually contributing about $500 million to the net operating costs. So it's big. So the report would put together the bus system, which is now operated under Metro Transit, together with the guideways, the fixed rail, which is now coming to us from CTIB. And we have that look. We could look at one document and see what exactly what we have got with these two systems. So the bill, some of it's quite technical. It's just definitions. Let's make sure we know what a busway is. Let's make sure we know what an express stop bus is versus a limited stop bus, things like that. So that's section one, essentially. And section two adds a cap, really, on how much of the operating cost should come in our system when it's complete from buses versus rail, fixed rail. So that's a way to say, you know, there's tremendous advantage to having flexibility in our transit system, and buses give us that. They currently transport about 75% of all the commuters in the Twin Cities. Rail is running about 18% total. What happens with buses is that typically the funding declines as there's more and more emphasis on light rail, and the number of passengers declines as well. So we actually saw that from 2013 to 2014, 44% of the increased ridership of transit was at the expense of the bus system. So yes, light rail increased about 6 million, but there was a significant decrease in the number of riders on the bus system. So in order to keep them proportional in a way that makes most financial sense, this is what that piece does. Number three is about requiring that there be a study and that we impose a fare increase, but taking a look at where it makes sense, maybe what kinds of fares there should be. Differential pricing might work if we've got some trains that are very much connected to, say, big events in the city and so on. And fourth is a prohibition on Southwest Light Rail and Bottineau from full funding agreements to be signed for both of those systems. And that is essentially the bill, members.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. I know there's an amendment, but I would entertain questions. If I don't see any, then Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question for Chair Runbeck is, I was just wondering, why didn't this travel with what we kind of see as the Metropolitan Council omnibus-type bill? How come is this traveling separately?
Representative Runbeck.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's many, you know, a lot of moving parts in the transit world right now in the Twin Cities. So the CTIP dissolution is imminent. I think we need to be responsive to the fact that, you know, as each week passes, there could be some different scenarios. We want to be ready for that.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Runbeck. When I'm going through all the things that you're putting through, and especially like actually mandating a fare increase, typically I'm having a problem trying to determine what is good policy and what is micromanaging. I mean, it's a lot of what I'm seeing to me normally would be considered, in my experience, micromanaging.
Representative Runbeck.
I guess maybe it depends on what point of view you're coming from. And I think that I've watched this process for about 6 years. And the fact that it's so hard to get information and good information, I think that's really part of what getting involved in. But we have two reports. You're talking about the reports, Representative?
No, it's, I mean...
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck. Things like saying that the bus service needs to be raising the fare. I mean, that to me should be, we've got people hired to do that, and for the legislature to say it's time for you to raise the fare, to me is micromanaging, especially when they're telling you that they already have a study going on regarding that fact.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, I think it's been, 8 years since they have raised the fare. We know that we're looking at, 33% roughly is the amount of recovery from the fare box, and the state taxpayers are subsidizing 66% of the total cost of the transit system. So I think we need to recognize that there are probably some ways that we can sort of upgrade or change the fare system to recover more. That's really all we're saying. Given the state is, you know, backing up the costs and the financing.
Just one last comment is the fact that that is a fairly good percentage when you look across the nation. So how are you having expectations that are higher than almost other cities?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, we know there are some lines that are that have, what, 70% fare box recovery. So, I mean, there's some very good results. Maybe we should be trying to replicate more of those. Maybe there are truly routes that just simply do not, you know, deserve anymore to be running. So I think it's just that ability to kind of keep a little bit of a monitoring system going between the legislature and Met Council.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Runbeck, my question is about the prohibiting the federal agreements. I understand that the federal government's pretty close to signing off a big chunk of money to do the Southwest Light Rail. How much is that? Is the value of that contract? And how many jobs would we forego if we did not take that contract?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the amount is $895 million that we're looking at. it's a very narrow window here. A lot, you know, can happen with this train. It's a big debate. If we want to talk about why, we can talk about why. But we just heard from the federal government that they are looking at cutting perhaps 16 lines, cutting funding for those. So that's, you know, certainly in the mix as well.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rebeck, again, that $895 million would produce how many jobs?
Representative Rundeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think our priorities have to be about mobility and about what kind of obligations we're taking on for the future. I mean, into perpetuity, we then will be responsible for everything on the operating, on the capital repair, capital maintenance, and capital replacement of that system and any that are to come. It's an enormous obligation that we're taking on. And when you look at it, there's no way other than to say it's about a $4 billion cost for one line over 25 years. I mean, that's like $275 million per car it takes off the road. I mean, it just does not make sense. And so we are putting that ahead of everything else that the state is obligated to fund: public education, public safety, water infrastructure. It doesn't add up. And so this is the moment in time that we have to say, stop. Stop the insanity. This is not about mobility, even. If that would be great if it was about mobility. It's about economic development for Hennepin County, Ramsey County. That's not a justification for that kind of cost upon all taxpayers.
Are you done, Representative Johnson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that we heard testimony earlier that this would produce thousands of jobs, good-paying jobs, with people from all across the state likely working on the project as they did on the Central Corridor. And I didn't hear an answer to that question, but I think that that's very relevant for Minnesota to walk away from, by law, for sure, from $895 million worth of a development. That's we're walking away from a lot. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question pertains to page 5, section 3, related to mandating a fare increase for Metro Transit, and I believe also the suburban transit operators are included. But could you outline a little bit how your process is different from the existing Met Council process on fare increase, which I understand they're about to or may have already set in motion that process?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, the one thing I know about the Met Council's process is that they have about 90 days from the date that they announce they're going to look at the fares to when they could raise them. And I believe if you look at that 90-day period, that puts it outside of the framework of the legislature. So conceivably, while they are saying they might look at and might change the fares, we don't know that they will. So I think we need this backup to say, you know, there's a lot to look at here. There's a lot to consider. Other entities that run transit use technology to make sure that if people are boarding that they have a ticket. The arterial bus rapid transit has an off-platform method of having a ticket. So, I mean, I think that we should not just necessarily say, look at it and you decide. I think we should know, and we should have some input on that.
Representative Hornstein, follow-up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to get the Met Council's perspective on that. But I guess my concern is that, you know, you have a public participation process laid out. But then in page 5, line 14, you basically say the Met Council must impose a fare increase. So this is why the public gets so cynical about government. You know, we're already prejudging, you know, what the outcome is. So we're going to have a whole public process, then the public will weigh in, but we've already determined that there's going to be a fare increase in statute. So why even go through that? I would think a public process on any issue that a public entity is considering should be sincere, that we should actually propose something, whether it's in local government or state government or federal government, whatever the proposal is. We propose it, allow the public to weigh in, maybe make some changes, and then based on that public input, make a decision. So, you know, we're already preordaining the public process by having the must language on line 14 on page 5. So I'm very concerned about that, Mr. Chair, and I have problems with this entire bill, but I think, you know, mandating a fare increase and then asking the public whether that's a good idea or not once we've said in law that it is seems a little bit premature.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rumbeck, where does the Chamber of Commerce stand on your bill pertaining to Southwest? And my second part of the question would be, United Healthcare is out there. They're expecting 7,000 new employees over the next decade. They went and built their own station with their own money. So I don't understand why we would not take this money and get this line up and running as quick as possible. It's going to have huge effects on jobs, on families, and on businesses. So I think it's a really, really bad idea.
I did not hear a question there, Representative. I believe we have a testimony. What's that? Is there a question? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. Do you know where the Chamber of Commerce stands on Southwest Light Rail?
I did hear you, Representative. I just forgot. Representative Rundell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenthal, I have not specifically talked to them lately. I mean, I think that they have couched most of their positions in the support for transit system, a viable transit system. I don't know exactly what they would say about your question.
Follow-up, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rumbeck, they're in full support of Southwest Light Rail.
Thank you. I believe we have a testifier. If you would step forward and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Thompson with the Met Council. Just here to respectfully oppose this bill and talk about a few elements of it. Many of it was already talked about. The first section of it does reconstitute the guideway report that is currently produced every 2 years by MnDOT with the help of Met Council for data. This would change it to an annual report with quite a bit more reporting. And by transferring it to the Met Council, we just want to make you aware that there is a fiscal impact of that section of the bill. The second part of it would cap our budget and restrict us in terms of flexibility of the budget in the long term for light rail. Currently, our light rail is about, as it was testified, about 18% of the budget. But looking forward to the future, the most flexibility we can have, this would take away some of that flexibility. As has been stated before this committee before, we are in the process of considering a fare increase proposal. We expect that on the current timeline, we would go to the public with some options and start to seek public input at some point in April of this year. Much of the content of what would be required to analyze the different options as laid out in the bill, we will be conducting that. We'll be looking at peer groups, definitely taking in public input and trying to influence and design what a possible fare increase would be. Also, we'll have the conclusion of the legislative process to understand the revenue impacts and revenue needs from a fare increase. And so, but we would, we're following a federal process for the public input, and is often a question we ask is, does my input matter? And as I read the bill, we would be required to pass a fare increase no matter what the public input process was. And then lastly, we oppose it on the context that the bill would prevent the construction of the Southwest LRT line, which is anticipated to begin construction this year. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. We have a question from Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome back, Mr. Thompson. Can you give us a little bit of background on the fare box recovery? What is the formula that the Met Council uses currently, or what are the calculations that you take into consideration for that?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, we are looking at the operating cost of the line, so that looks into the actual cost for operations. Then we consider in any revenue that the systems take in. The two main places of revenue would be obviously fares, and some of the lines take advertising revenue and some other revenues such as leases and some small indicators like that. We do not consider long-term capital investment or capital cost in that fare box recovery ratio, if that answers your question.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thompson, thank you. I believe our previous committee and policy asked for some of those to consider some of the capital and capital costs and outlays to be factored in and to compare so that we have a good indication of that. So we'll look forward to that information. I'm told it's kind of forthcoming. And Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask Mr. Thompson and the Met Council. The President has announced some of his proposed budget and some of the New START funding. Can you share with the committee what the discussion has been on the Met Council with some of the budget announcements on the New STARTs and how that affects this basically predetermined money that the Southwest is getting and the Botno lines seem to be getting, because looking at this, his budget doesn't look like it's such a foregone conclusion that that money is actually going to be there.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, on the first part, yes, we will be having that information, I believe, this week about looking at capital costs in the fare box recovery. Second part of the question, I won't speculate on when any budgets are going to be passed at the federal level, but the Southwest LRT is anticipated to be requesting the full funding grant agreement this summer, and then if that was to receive, the project could move forward. Without the New START money for the project, is unlikely to move forward.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Thompson, I was heading out of town back to beautiful Kaneohe County on Friday, and it was St. Patrick's Day, and I noticed that the light rail was offering free rides on an anticipated night where people might need a ride home. I think from public safety, that's a good thing. I operate a bar and a restaurant, and I know that there are times we should try to do everything we can to get our folks home. What happens financially when you offer that? Are there sponsors for these nights? I'm just curious how those are financed through those kind of announcements when you guys do that. I appreciate that update.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for that question. Yes, that is a very good public service that is provided to keep the roads safe. And the St. Patrick's Day was sponsored by Miller Brewing Company, so they cover the entire cost of providing those free trips in that instance. Other instances may come up where there's a sponsor who comes forward to sponsor to have free rides. So it depends on the event, but the one from Friday, I believe, was Miller Brewing Company.
Representative Hausen, or follow-up,
follow-up, Mr. Chair, please. Is that safe to say that, does that cover the fare boxes that night of whatever it would have been, or Or is it full cost? And is it safe to assume that any night, any time you do a free ridership program, it's sponsored by somebody?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, the I guess the Friday night event would be covered. Any fare that would have been paid by a customer is covered by the entity that sponsored it. So it would be the fare costs that are not paid at that time that are covered by one for one. There are certain events like an opening of a new facility. Sometimes they do a first day free or something to get people familiar with the service. And I can't comment on past ones, but, you know, that's on something that would be different if you were to open, I think, like the Red Line opening or something, the BRT system. Sometimes they do a way to attract new customers to understand and have an education program. That's different than an event like Friday night.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've told us at a previous committee when that question was asked about capital costs, a couple of issues. One is that the rail cars, the length of life, the length of service is far more than the bus, so we're going to be replacing the bus much more quickly. But then also, isn't it the number of passengers, and I'll just take the Green Line, carries the massive amount of, I mean, I don't think there's anything else that's carrying so many passengers. So when you do subsidy per passenger, even after you've factored in capital costs, because there are so many passengers, the cost of the subsidy per passenger just presumably is still going to be lower than the rest of the system. Would that be fair to assume?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that is fair to assume. The if you think about the life cycle of a light rail system, the LRT cars are about 35 years on average. We haven't reached that life cycle on them, so we're not sure exactly. And then you're building other infrastructure like rail and bridges and facilities that have a very, very long life. And compared to buses, which you're replacing on average, say, 12 years or less, depending on Metro Mobility buses, every 5 years. And so those are turning over quite frequently. And, of course, they also need a road to ride on. We wouldn't be factoring in the cost of that road and how often they need to be maintained. But we're expecting, and the information that we're gathering will provide to you as soon as we get it here, that would factor in that life, age, and the fact that an LRT car, which carries a lot more people and has a much longer life, will factor into the cost per ride subsidy information that we provide back to this committee and to others. But
a follow-up, Representative.
And then, Mr. Chair, I think on Section 2, as I recall, I wish I brought that sheet. There's a very helpful sheet that shows the subsidy per passenger and fare box recovery for absolutely every single line. And we were reminded that Greater Minnesota has a fare box recovery of 15%, I think. So a Section 2 seems to go after the very part of the system that is lowest subsidy per passenger and highest fare box recovery already in this existing time. Am I missing something?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hussman. Yes, I wish I would have brought that sheet also. But, yes, the LRT has the lowest subsidy of the main fixed route services per trip. And then there was, depends on if you do a dollar amount or percentage of operating costs. It ranged from, you know, some of the services on some of the local suburban routes were very single-digit fare box recovery rates to a couple express type services for buses at 54%, I recall is the highest, but there's quite a range depending on the service, and the LRT is one of the more efficient systems.
And so, Mr. Chair, one
final
more
question, Representative Hauser.
The Section 3, I'm interested in whether we're using the right language here, because just given what you just talked about, when we say increase regular route transit fares, only that section, does that exclude express buses of suburban transit? Because on that sheet, they are listed separately from the line on regular route.
Representative Rundle.
So I'm just concerned we're or I guess that would be to the Met Council person.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm trying to look for the definition of
I think it's Section 3.
Right.
Line 5.15.
We generally break out our service into local bus or local urban and then express rather than regular route. So that would probably possibly exclude express service from that. Though it's a regular, we could easily provide the express bus reporting on this. So the plan that we have in place or that we're moving forward with in terms of the fare increase is looking at all services in the Twin Cities. So we are looking at potential proposal for fare increase on express, local, Metro Mobility, and Transit Link. So that's the different options that we're considering, not just local bus.
And so, Mr. Chair, I would just a suggestion, Representative Runbeck, if that definition thing would be something you'd look at, because I'm assuming it's your intention to treat all buses the same.
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct, yes. So we'll take a look at that language. It needs to be adjusted and, you know, made parallel to everything.
Representative Kosnick, a second time at bat in the same inning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thompson, when we're talking about the life expectancy of the light rail train cars, you're throwing out the number of 35 years. Are there other systems that you're basing that off of? You're basing that off of manufacturers? Or let me know. Homes barely last 35 years without needing some major repairs.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are basing that off of manufacturer and other systems and also our maintenance plan. We obviously maintain vehicles throughout their life to get their longest life. So that's kind of the point where we'd completely replace the vehicle. But during that time, there's routine maintenance in order to preserve the longevity of those vehicles. But they definitely have a much longer life than a bus for a variety of reasons.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck, any final comments? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I forgot. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the clock and thinking about other things. I'm sorry. But before, yeah, so I believe we've answered all the questions, and now we do have an amendment to attend to. Thank
Mr.
you for
Chair,
reminding me.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A6 amendment. And
to the A6.
And, Mr. Chair, as we've heard talking here about and questioning of the bill, it's been brought up about mobility. The reason we have a transit system is to allow people to get to and from where they need to go, work, job, or work, doctor, play, all the things that we do in our lives. The transit system is there designed to allow people to get to where they need to get to. And it's a system. It's not just one route or another route. And the amendment I have deletes Section 4 of the bill because we need to build out this system. We've been working on these two lines that we're cutting out of here. They're part of the system that's designed to get people all over our city and help. There was talk about economic development. That's the only reason they're being built, and that's not really true. But they do help with economic development. They help with people being able to get to their jobs, get to homes, and businesses like to build along these lines because they know there's going to be readily available customers, readily available employees that they can get to and from work. And so all these reasons why we're building out this system. And the other reason why I put this amendment forward is we've been paying our taxes, federal taxes, to the U.S. government for these lines, for these fast start lines, for these rail lines. They come out of taxes we've already paid as Minnesotans into the federal government. By building these lines, we're getting that money back that we've already paid in. If we don't build these lines ourselves, that money that we paid in isn't going to come back to us for roads, isn't going to come back to us for bus lines. That money's going to go to other states that are building, and Republican states that are building transit lines, like Texas, like Colorado. They're building these lines, and they're investing in it because they know that they return back to their state economies jobs, taxes, the people pay on those jobs, and they're helping spur those economies and make those states stronger. That's what these lines will do for us, and so that's why I'm bringing forward the A6 amendment, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. We can only wish that the federal government was piling up our tax dollars in order that they could send them back out to us or anyone else. I'm afraid it's all borrowed money. Any other comments to the amendment? Representative Runbeck, do you have any comments to the amendment before we vote? Representative Runbeck first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just counter that we've heard many times that
that LRT is a catalyst for economic development. That's the first thing you read about when you read their documents, CTIB and Met Council. And then in the statute that set forth CTIB, its number one mission is to maximize the availability and uses of federal funding. Now, some may think that's really a smart idea, but I think that you may be getting ourselves into buying the most expensive, building the most expensive project in state history, which is what we have. So I think the planning on this has been misguided. We have been led by some, I think, beliefs that I don't think hold true. So I would just encourage that this amendment be voted down.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to strongly support Representative Nelson's amendment. I mean, there's businesses, chamber, other cities, other states to support what we're doing. This the whole bill really undermines everything that has been taking place. It's taking us back to, I don't know, we want to go back to the horse and buggy, but again, this is a real practical amendment that needs to be added to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. I see no other comments. We will now vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the A6 amendment as moved by Representative Nelson, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment fails. To the bill, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, I think that where we need to go is that major transit capital investments must start at the legislative process and have that explicit authorization so we know what we are spending and where we are headed with the cost associated. So I urge your support of the bill.
Would you like to renew your motion, Representative Runbeck?
Yes, thank you. I'll renew my motion for House Bill 1480 to go to Ways and Means.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
You're on your way, Representative Runbeck. GOP members, as soon as we adjourn here this afternoon, we are going to meet in room 454 immediately after this meeting. No other business to come before us. This meeting is adjourned.